and welcome to the Road to Genome podcast. I'm your host, Helen Bethel, genetic counsellor and workforce development and education lead for the Northeastern Yorkshire Genomic Medicine Service, or GMS. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Sir John Byrne, and he's here to discuss his incredible work into the condition Lynch syndrome. So lovely to speak to you, John.
Hi, Helen.
So your specialism is a condition called Lynch syndrome. Can you explain for our listeners what exactly that is?
Yes, I can. First of all, I started working on it before we called it Lynch syndrome. Henry was a close friend and colleague, and he did all the work to promote it. So we used that eponym, although in fact it was a guy called Eldred Warthin who described in his seamstress's family, this family
really?
History of endometrial and gastric and sometimes bowel cancer.
Yeah.
And Henry popularized it at a time when people just would not accept that cancer runs in families. So it used to be called the cancer family syndrome, mm-hmm. and it's still quite a good name. You know, it's a condition that runs in families that predisposes to cancer.
Yeah.
And we struggle to identify the underlying inheritance pattern because it doesn't just cause one type of cancer, it mm-hmm. causes a whole range of cancers, mm-hmm. particularly bowel cancer, endometrial cancer, cancer of the upper GI tract, like the stomach, the urothelial tract, the kidneys and ureters, which I'm particularly interested in now. And so you'd see a family where there were lots of people getting cancer, but they're all different cancers, so mm-hmm. people didn't join the dots mm-hmm. and realize it was a condition. The underlying mechanism, we knew it was genetic back in the early 90s, and we originally called it hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer, which is a bit of a weird name. But in the late 80s, we'd spent, all of us were chasing the gene familial adenomatous polyposis, or the APC gene as it became known, adenomatous polyposis coli, where teenagers get thousands of polyps in their bowel. And it's a very dramatic dominant trait. All get cancer if you don't take out the colon. And the gene was tracked down to chromosome 5. But in searching for that gene, we were all identifying these families where there were lots of cancers, but there weren't any polyps. So we called it non-polyposis colon cancer, which was a sort of catch-all title for linkage study. It was a mm-hmm. an academic title just mm-hmm. to group the families,
yeah.
but it became absorbed into clinical practice. It was a stupid name, you know, describing you as having not something else. You know,
yeah.
so this is hereditary non-diabetic diabetes, or you know,
yeah.
so we actually killed that name and gave the name Lynch instead. We're in at the ground level of this because working with Tim Bishop in Leeds, we'd mapped two big families in the Northeast, one called the Durham family with multiple, about 35 people with bowel cancer, and another in Northumberland who were all related to a shepherd who had in total 3 gastrointestinal cancers and 9 skin cancers before he died. And we mapped it to chromosome 2 just at the time that the yeast geneticist in Boston realized that there was something odd about the tumours in these patients. They had thousands of spelling mistakes. And because they worked on yeast genes, they knew that probably meant it was a problem with mismatch repair.
Yeah.
This is the body spell checker. But they needed human DNA to test the idea.
Yeah.
So we gave them some of our DNA, as did one or two other colleagues, and they found a mutation in the MSH2 gene in our family. It transpired it was actually not the pathogenic variant,
mm-hmm.
but because we already had linkage data, mm-hmm. we could use it as an intragenic linkage marker in our family. So we did the very first diagnostic test for MSH2 in 1994.
Fantastic.
And very rapidly thereafter, the Durham family was shown to be MLH1, and then we're all off and running. And so we now have a collection of genes, and there are basically 4 key genes, although there are about 16 different mismatch repair genes. But the key thing is that the reason that the yeast geneticist found it is that every cellular organism uses this same spell checker to mm-hmm. spell check its DNA as mm-hmm. it copies it.
Mm-hmm.
And the spell checker concept is quite useful because most people now recognize on a computer,
yes.
you type something and the spell checker underlines something that was wrong. And so that's what these genes do. They follow the polymerase, and if they see a spelling mistake, they pull it back and run it again.
Yeah.
And it's happening thousands of times even while we're speaking in our body. And what happens in Lynch syndrome is that you have a faulty copy of one of your mismatch mm-hmm. repair genes.
Mm-hmm.
Your spell checker is susceptible to breakdown. It still works, but because we get genes in matching pairs, every cell in your body is running with one working copy of that gene.
Yeah.
And any slip up in your lifetime that breaks that copy, and suddenly the entire system breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
So now spelling mistakes don't get corrected. And just as if you're reading a book that could accumulate spelling mistakes, inevitably it will lead to major problems. Either it'll kill the cell, which is probably what happens mostly, but sometimes it will knock out the genes whose job is to stop cancer happening. Mm-hmm. So it's a very complex process. So it isn't causing cancer, it's causing spelling mistakes in genes whose job is to stop cancer. So therefore, cancers become more common.
Yeah.
And we still don't really understand why it is, for example, you don't particularly get breast cancer, but you get lots of bowel cancer. Yeah. So there's still things to learn about how these genes are expressed in tissues. Mm-hmm. But what it gave us was a handle on two levels. First of all, we could sequence these genes and identify which gene and which spelling mistake was running in the family, which is powerful. But also, we developed tests for these spelling mistakes. Mm-hmm. And the bits of the DNA that are most susceptible to going wrong are called microsatellites, yeah. which is an ancient term from the 1970s when we used to use electrophoresis to separate DNA. Mm-hmm. The little tiny repetitive bits sort of ran off the end and they were called microsatellites. So those repetitive bits of DNA yeah. are the hardest to copy
yeah.
because if you've got 10 A's in a row, it's very easy to accidentally only put 9 in. And if you do that in a gene, it's devastating because genes are read, as you know, in sets of 3. So if you take out one letter, everything goes back one mm-hmm. and the rest of the gene becomes gobbledygook. And so the slightest error in a repetitive bit of DNA inside a gene is devastating to that mm-hmm. gene function. So what happens is you get these microsatellites change in length. That's what underlies most of the genetic damage. And it means we can use that as a very quick test of the function of this system. So we have a sets of these repetitive bits of DNA. And if they're changing in length in a tumor, we call it microsatellite instability.
Yeah.
Then we know that the mismatch repair system is broken in that tumor. In most cases, it will have broken in the tumor as part of the tumor's progression. But of course, in a proportion, it's an inherited defect, mm-hmm. which is Lynch syndrome. Mm-hmm. So what was fascinating was that we went in 1993 from having a hunch as to where one of the genes might be.
Yeah.
In 12 months, we had the entire story because the bacterial geneticists had completely worked out how these genes worked. Mm-hmm. And so we just had to transplant that knowledge into humans.
Yeah.
And it was really quite spectacular because we then realized that this was way more common than familial adenomatous polyposis.
Yeah.
And I became kind of an officer in, there were these two groups, the Leeds Castle group doing FAP and the International Collaborative Group on HNPCC. And I ended up being the chair of one and the secretary of the other, and a few of us said, why can't we put these together? We're all doing the same thing, we're just dealing with slightly different families. Mm-hmm. And it took us years, but we eventually persuaded, the most recalcitrant was Hans Varsen, who ran the Hereditary Tumors mm-hmm. Center in Netherlands. So I flew over there and I said, look, we're going to call it INSITE, the International Society for Gastrointestinal Hereditary Tumors.
Yeah.
So your title's still in. And he with that persuasion, he agreed. So we had the very first meeting of INSITE in 2005 here in Newcastle. Yeah. And it's just gone from strength to strength because what we now realize is that about 3 in every 1,000 babies born mm-hmm. has this condition. So it's actually not that rare. You know, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people in Britain mm-hmm. who have a spelling mistake in one of these genes. Slightly annoyingly, as a clinician, people now call anyone with a pathogenic variant in one of these 4 genes as having Lynch syndrome. Mm-hmm. Now, technically, they don't. They have a pathogenic variant in the mismatch repair gene,
yeah.
and they might get cancer.
Yeah.
And if they get cancer, then they've got the phenotype of Lynch yeah. syndrome. But the reality is that if you know someone's got this condition, you have to offer them regular checkups.
Mm-hmm.
So it is okay to call it Lynch syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
But it is enormously common, and we're missing most of them because partly because we didn't have the tools, partly because everyone was so preoccupied with familial transmission.
Yeah.
And we had the thing called the Amsterdam criteria, which were drawn up really just to help us do the linkage studies.
Yeah.
And you had to have 3 people in 2 generations. And what that did was effectively exclude most of the families.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to just stop using family history altogether. And now we've got national guidance in our country and most others that you test the tumors for microsatellite instability.
Mm-hmm.
That will identify the study population for looking for Lynch syndrome. Mm. And we've done a lot of research on this because it wasn't working. And in fact, we now know, we've just published a paper from the National Disease Registry in England, mm-hmm. And in July of last year, there were 9,030 people known to the NHS in England with Lynch syndrome.
Wow.
Which is a lot.
Yeah.
But it's actually a fraction of the number that we know are out there, because if you sequence just a group of people from the UK Biobank, the one paper recently published, one in 400 of them had a pathogenic mutation.
Wow.
Other studies suggest it's even more common, but even at one in 400, that's 100,000 people out there that we're not picking up.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is we're not systematically testing for it. Mm-hmm. And what we have done successfully is moved away from the old-fashioned method. So there were two methods of looking for the breakdown of the system. Mm-hmm. One was using a thing called Oncomate, which uses very big fragments of DNA, like 26 T's in a row. And it's very susceptible to breakdown, but you can't run it through a next-generation sequencer.
Okay.
So you have to use the old-style machines. Secondly, that identifies about one in six bowel cancers, but you then need to thin it down before you do germline testing. So we then add another test called BRAF, which is a driver mutation. Yeah. If it's present, it's probably not hereditary. So what we've done is taken new markers, which we've spent years developing, which are small markers, so you can run them through next-generation machines, so you don't have to use the old tech. And we've added in BRAF and the RAS mutations. Mm-hmm. All the other mutations are in the same kit.
Yeah.
So in one step, in a week, the sample comes in, we analyze it, we say, this is MSI high, it's BRAF negative, this patient needs a test for Lynch syndrome. And we know that before they even have their surgery. We do that on their biopsies. Mm-hmm. And that's transformed in our region. So we've actually stopped doing the other method, which is immunohistochemistry. Mm-hmm. What you're doing there is using an antibody staining method to look for the four proteins from the four genes. And it works, but it's expensive, it's laborious, it requires expert interpretation. So we've basically said, look, let's stop doing immunohistochemistry, let's stop doing the old PCR test, and let's use our assay called the MSI Plus assay. And we're gaining traction now. The government gave us nearly £2 million to roll it out.
Fantastic.
So it's now it's fully operational in our region. It's rolling into Yorkshire as we speak, and into Manchester, into Birmingham, into Bristol. And we're constantly refining it and building it into the new technology so that it gives you a cheap and cheerful MSI test. Even if your whole genome sequencing fails, you'll still get the MSI test.
Yep.
And it's very exciting because it actually hopefully will dramatically improve the number of people being diagnosed as they come through.
Yep.
And as you know, if someone presents with cancer, they're much more amenable to investigation and advice and counselling. Yep. So if we can identify Lynch patients accurately and at speed, then we can get into the families.
Yep.
And Tristan Snowsell and Ian Fraley did a lovely piece of work about 10 years ago showing that this is actually economically viable.
Yes.
Because if you pick up a couple of Lynch patients and get them onto surveillance, then you will stop people dying of cancer and costing the NHS a fortune. So it is self-funding.
Yeah.
And we've now, you know, really caught the ear of the government in getting that transformation program running. Mm-hmm. But it's there's still a lot of work to do because, of course, even when you find them, you've then got to get them into surveillance.
Yes.
We've now got the National Bowel Cancer Screening Program adopting it. So that's great because it means that we can get them high-quality colonoscopy. We've now got agreement that they can be identified in the National Disease Registration Service. So effectively, we have a national registry, which is live and ongoing. Mm-hmm. And we've now got endometrial cancers all being tested pretty effectively. So that's great. Mm-hmm. What we're missing is two things. First of all, we're missing the urothelial cancers. Mm-hmm. So we've just started a project and we're rolling it out nationally now. Mm-hmm. We looked at all of our MSH2 gene carriers in our region. Mm-hmm. We asked 163 to come forward. 83 of them did and gave us a urine sample because we had a hunch our test was so sensitive we could pick up cancers, and it proved to be the case. So we picked up five cancers in that group in the urinary tract. And so that obviously brings a new dimension because it's cheap and it's easy to do. And so we're rolling that out nationally. And in fact, what we now know from our prospective Lynch syndrome database is that one in 20 people with Lynch syndrome actually die of a cancer in their kidney, ureter, or bladder. Because we're not looking. Mm-hmm. You know, we're looking at the endometrium and the colon.
Yeah.
The second big gap is the misunderstanding of colonoscopy. The patients with Lynch syndrome still get bowel cancer. Mm-hmm. You pick it up earlier, but because of the way it develops in the wall, regular colonoscopy does not prevent it. Mm-hmm. And we've demonstrated with colleagues in Heidelberg that basically a lot of these cancers probably just emerge as cancer. They come mm-hmm. out of an aberrant crypt, and mm-hmm. there's lots of them, and the immune system holds most of them at bay. But mm-hmm. if it loses control, up pops a cancer. Mm-hmm. But it's actually quite slow growing, and yeah. it can't metastasize easily because one of the genes it is almost always knocked out is called B2M. And B2M is necessary to put your HLA tissue type on the surface. Mm-hmm. If you lose B2M, it's great. It becomes like a Harry Potter invisibility cloak. Mm-hmm. So you can hide in plain sight in the colon wall. Mm-hmm. But if you go into the circulation, the T killer cells out there see you're walking around without a passport and mm-hmm. they zap you. So basically these tumors don't metastasize. Mm-hmm. So it's great. So we can, as long as we get a colonoscopy every couple of years, we'll almost certainly prevent them dying of bowel cancer. Mm-hmm. But we don't prevent the bowel cancers.
Yep.
What we do know is that we can prevent bowel cancer with aspirin,
yeah.
Which I'm sure you would want me to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I was going to remark on how enthusiastic you are about all the developments that have happened within Lynch syndrome over the years. And I was going to ask you about your particular area of research with aspirin. So tell us that story.
So it actually began with FAP, mm-hmm. And it began with a little boy called Jonathan. And I went to see him with Pam Chapman, our genetic nurse specialist mm-hmm. at the time. This is when we're mapping families. And mother had had a panproctocolectomy and she had osteomas, little bumps on her forehead, which are one of the extracolonic features. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan had them too. So literally walking into the room, I knew he was a gene carrier.
Yeah.
But he just had a colonoscopy and it was clear. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could prevent him from getting polyps in the first place? Could we try medication of some sort? And I had the idea that these were like canaries down the mine, you know, that they were the more susceptible people.
Yeah.
They get cancer at a young age. Mm-hmm. They're very motivated. We know there's not that many of them, but they get lots of cancers and lots of polyps. So it's a great study population. And we set up a trial with European funding called the Concerted Action Polyposis Prevention, which then became CAP, which then became the Cancer Prevention Program. And it began with FAP and we recruited a couple of hundred. And then we started to realize how hard this was. So we picked on two interventions. One of them was aspirin, because there was a lot of noise at the time about people who took a lot of aspirin seemed to get less bowel cancer. So I thought, well, that's one to try.
Yep.
And the other one was resistant starch or fermentable mm-hmm. fiber, mm-hmm. because Dennis Burkitt came back from Africa and said, rural Africans don't get bowel cancer. You know, we think it's their fiber. And so that started a whole research community, and I was involved with them through John Mathers, our professor of human nutrition. And of course, you can randomize starch. You can give ordinary corn starch, or you can give potato starch or other stuff, but they all yeah. look like white powder.
Yeah.
And so we set up a little study. We realized it was hard. Teenagers don't like taking food supplements and tablets. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We couldn't count. We videoed their polyps and stuff, but there's so many of them, you couldn't work out whether you'd prevented
it
them.
It changed
or not.
On, yeah.
But then, just as we launched that, of course, we discovered mm-hmm. that we were part of the discovery of Lynch syndrome. We found the MSH2 gene. Mm-hmm. Here were people in their mid-40s and 50s getting cancer. They mm-hmm. didn't get polyps. They mm-hmm. just got lots of cancer. Mm-hmm. So we immediately started planning CAP2 using the same interventions of starch and aspirin in what's called a factorial design. So I was part of the team that did the MRC vitamin trial mm-hmm. to show that folic acid prevents spina bifida. Wow. And that was designed by Nick Walls, great mathematician. And you basically have four boxes. You either get, in that case, folic acid or multivitamins, or folic acid and multivitamins, or neither.
Placebo.
And we were able to show that folic acid prevented spina bifida. So I used exactly the same design, and you either got starch, aspirin, both, or neither. And it took us several years to persuade everybody to play. And it also, I kind of expected there'd be lots and lots of these families, but everyone was really slow. So we ended up in 16 countries and 43 centres.
Yeah.
It took a while. Yeah. but we started recruiting in 1999. We had our target 1,000 by 2005 when Insight was held, and we said we'd treat them for 2 years. We actually treated for up to 4 years, but we finished in 2007. And to our dismay, nothing worked. In other words, we looked at the cancer rates in the two groups and there was no difference. However, We'd also planned to look at polyps, because everyone said if you prevent polyps, you prevent cancer. But we didn't affect the polyp counts either. And we almost lost our funding, but we kept going. And then we said, well, let's just count the cancers, because we're running out of time and money. And when a couple of years later we counted the cancers, we could see a difference. Wow. So in 2011, we published a paper. The people who'd taken the aspirin had a 50% lower rate of bowel cancer. Wow. So that caused a big stir. We kept on going because our plan was to follow for 10 years.
Yeah.
And so we got to that in 2017. Then we had to kind of pull all the data from all the databases. So it wasn't until 2020 that we published the definitive paper.
Yeah.
And the exciting thing was it was still 50% reduction, but it was now intention to treat.
Yeah.
That means that if you were recruited to the aspirin limb, even if you didn't take the aspirin,
yeah,
the effect was powerful enough to be statistically significant. So yeah, that really convinced the world. Mm-hmm. And we went back and had a look at the starch, which had also been negative. And to our amazement, it worked too. So we expected the starch to have an impact on bowel cancer, and it didn't, which probably goes back to what I was saying about how these cancers are different. They just kind of come up as cancer. So changing the diet maybe doesn't affect the bowel that much. Mm-hmm. But weirdly, it affected all the other cancers. So there was a 60% reduction in gastric cancer, pancreatic cancer, liver cancer.
Wow.
All the other cancers went down.
That's incredible.
And we planned that as a secondary analysis.
Yeah.
So that won a prize in 2022. So it basically means if you put people on aspirin and put them on resistant starch or a fiber diet, high fiber diet, you will more than halve their cancer burden. And we've got nice guidance for the first of those. But our problem was we were using two aspirins a day, which is actually not that much for young people, but everyone was worried about it. So we'd always said, we'll go high. And then CAP 3 has just about finished this year, was giving different doses of aspirin. Mm-hmm. So we have 1,879 people in five countries now who have been taking either 600, 300 or 100 milligrams of aspirin. We blinded them for 2 years so that we could see what the side effect profile was. We followed them for five, and the last person gets their last visit in June.
Okay.
Then we'll count the cancers. Mm-hmm. And the question is, do you get as big a protection against bowel cancer with a baby aspirin as you do with two aspirins?
Yes.
My suspicion is, the answer will be yes. And the reason for that is twofold. First of all, when we set up CAP2, there's another big trial set up called the Women's Health Study, which just basically gave a baby aspirin every other day to 18,000 women in America. And they followed them for 10 years, and they gave them vitamin E as well on the alternate days. And after 10 years, there was no effect. But after we published our paper in 2011, there was also an amazing paper by Peter Rothwell. He went back to 25,000 people who'd taken part in aspirin trials for heart attacks and strokes in the 1980s and 90s and went and tracked them down in the records to see what happened to them. And the people who'd been given the aspirin in those trials had about a 25 to 30% lower cancer risk in the following decade.
Yeah.
So we now had two lines of evidence that said that basically it works. And they went back and looked at their 18,000 women. And amazingly, after 10 years, the two lines separated. So the colon cancer rate went down in the women who'd been put on the aspirin. So we now had multiple lines of evidence to say it worked. But that was really low dose. So, and I've struggled with this for a long time, but in fact, I'm now part of a new research group, and we're just about to launch a new bid for funding, because what we've now realized is that we might be looking in the wrong place. We always assumed it was an anti-inflammatory effect, you know, like that's, you know, like joints and arthritis and things. But actually, if you give aspirin to someone once a day, the main thing you do is knock out their platelets. Now, that's a bit of a downside, because it means if you have a hemorrhage in your head, for example, it keeps on bleeding. So that's why people are a bit worried about aspirin, although that's really very rare. And if you have an ulcer, it'll bleed more if you've, you know, because your platelets are knocked out. But what our friends in Italy have demonstrated is that if you knock down the platelets, you secondarily knock down inflammation.
Okay.
So basically, there's two enzymes, COX-1 and COX-2, that aspirin blocks. And the COX-1 is in the platelets, COX-2 is inflammation. And they bred a mouse, which was a polyp-forming mouse, where they took out COX-1 and the polyps went away.
Wow.
So, and there's now a lot of evidence to suggest that what's happening is that in cancer, you get activated platelets. Mm-hmm. That drives the inflammatory response.
Okay.
Suppressing platelet activation will have a much more widespread impact on cancer progression.
Yeah.
And it also ties in why giving aspirin to people with cancer seems to improve their outcomes.
Yeah.
So we're part of the one of our group is runs the Add Aspirin trial, mm-hmm. which is looking at tens of thousands of people with cancer, giving them aspirin as part of their treatment. So it's all very exciting because it's coming together. And if our CAP3 trial says the same thing, what it means is that, in fact, a baby aspirin taken for a couple of years. Because the other dramatic thing in CAP2 was that we only treated them for 4 years and we're still seeing an effect at 15 years.
That's incredible.
So what almost certainly what's happened is that the aspirin has changed the body's reaction to these cells that one day might grow up to be cancer and has helped the body to destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
And the other group we're working with are immunologists. And we think that one of the reasons Lynch syndrome is so variable is it depends how good your immune system is at killing these cancers.
Mm-hmm.
And some people can kill them really well and they don't get cancer ever. And others aren't good at it and they get lots of cancers. And we've shown that we can count how many T cells they've got in the mucosa of their bowel. And the ones who don't have many T cells are much more likely to get cancer.
Yeah.
The other big breakthrough is that what's called immune checkpoint inhibitors. Now, these are drugs that basically deregulate your immune system. So your immune system has lots of little receptors on to say, don't shoot, I'm on your side.
Yep.
And so your body tells your T cells to hold fire. If you block those receptors, like PD-1 and CTLA-4, the white cells just could like an army running amok. They just go out and kill anybody they can find, which is obviously makes you feel unwell. But if you're a cancer with thousands of spelling mistakes, you stand out like, you know, the Blackpool Lights. So these drugs are massively effective at killing these cancers.
Yep.
And the other really exciting thing is that the reason the cancers are so visible is that when you get those frame shifts where you change, take one letter out and everything moves back, you make a funny little protein called a frame shift peptide, which then leaks out of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the immune system is seeing.
Recognize.
And our partners in Heidelberg have working for many years and now partners in Switzerland doing the same thing. Said, well, what if we actually injected those peptides into people and vaccinated them against these cancers?
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like it might work. It works in mice, and we now know that it's safe to do in humans. So there's now great enthusiasm for collecting together the sequences of these frameshift peptides, inserting them into a virus, and then injecting that into people. So they then see the peptides, make antibodies. Then when they get cancer, they kill the cancer themselves.
Yeah.
So it could just be that people with Lynch syndrome could be with a combination of vaccination and potentially kind of light finger on the trigger with immune checkpoint inhibitors and regular aspirin, we can almost take out the cancer risk altogether.
Yeah.
Which would be phenomenal because that's it's such a big burden, you know, from our population. But it also demonstrates the power of looking at these hereditary conditions where you've got such a high penetrance and there's such a highly motivated community.
Yep.
You can do stuff that you just never could do in the general population.
Yeah. Well, my next question was going to be how you've changed the lives of Lynch syndrome patients. But I think in what you've described, John, it's incredibly powerful to know that you've potentially given a treatment that can reduce their cancer risk by 50%, which is huge.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm delighted.
Yeah.
It was a lucky break. But also what's really distressing is that we still haven't got it into the British National Formulary. We've got nice guidance to recommend it, but it's still not prescribable for cancer. Mm-hmm. So that's the next big challenge.
Yeah.
And CAP3 will empower that. But what's fascinating is that a French physiologist in the 19th century called Claude Bernard said, it's what we think we know already that prevents us from learning. And all doctors know that aspirin causes ulcers and aspirin causes hemorrhage in the head. And, you know, and of course, if you work on hospital wards, you meet all these really old people coming in who've been on aspirin and having bleeds. And what we now know for sure is that the aspirin risk is in old people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're under 60, the chance of you ending up in hospital with aspirin is tiny.
Yeah.
And in fact, my colleague Carlo has done really detailed analysis. So the number needed to harm, you know, the number of people you need to treat before you do some significant medical harm is 1,667 if you're 40. It's 17 if you're 80.
Wow.
You know, so the simple answer is stop giving the aspirin to old people, but don't stop giving aspirin altogether.
Because you've seen that long-term effect.
And the benefits will roll out.
Then you need to give it early on. And then
the other thing is that in terms of strokes, if you have a hemorrhagic stroke, it's devastating, although you'll usually recover from it. But of course, most strokes are thrombotic strokes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take aspirin, you're way less likely to have a thrombus.
Yeah.
So actually, your risk of stroke goes down.
Yeah.
But there is a side effect risk of these hemorrhagic strokes, which gets sort of overblown.
Mm-hmm.
So the risk of giving someone a hemorrhagic stroke in their 40s, 50s, and 60s is significantly less than the risk of killing them with a colonoscopy.
Yeah.
But we never mention that. But everybody goes on and on about the risk of aspirin. You know, so it's just, need to sort of change this attitude towards aspirin.
Yeah.
And the patients mostly are relaxed about it, but trying to get a pharmacist to give you aspirin is just a nightmare.
Yeah.
So there's still, I mean, you know, it's a selling job basically, but at the moment, only about 30% of the people with Lynch are actually taking aspirin.
Yeah.
And we're still not doing enough of a selling job ourselves, along with all the other stuff that you should do, you know, don't drink, don't smoke, you know, which is missing the point. This is a specific intervention of high impact.
Yeah.
And so, as you can gather, I am passionate about it because it's not good enough just to get a paper that gets cited.
Yeah.
If you don't change the way people practice, then you're missing, you know, the main purpose of what we do. Yeah.
It's great to still hear your passion, as you've described, of, you know, kind of really wanting to bring that home into the medicine of the people and, you know, not even just to the privileged West, but also, you know, so it's wonderful to hear how you, you know, hold all the science and want to get it out there into everywhere that it can be of benefit. So my last question then is, out of everything that you've described, which is just an incredible amount, what would you recognise personally as your greatest achievement?
I think my greatest achievement was having the hunch that aspirin was worth testing and holding it together for 30 years.
Wow.
And herding and persuading clinicians and academics around the world to keep on going for 30 years has been an interesting challenge.
Yeah.
So I guess that has to be the one that I would pick out. And in truth, it's, you know, I was reading one of the actor who played in Ferris Bueller, and he used to be really cross that, you know, all he ever talked about was Ferris Bueller. Then he realised, actually, when you get older, it's nice you remember, you know,
something.
It's nice to have once have been something rather than never have been anything, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so if I only get remembered for saying aspirin prevents cancer, I'll settle for that.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much again, John, for coming and talking to us. It's been
My pleasure. Absolutely fantastic.
Never miss an episode by subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.